Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Lisa Scalotti from Waterbury Roundabout, sitting in for host Rick Zingari, who'll be back here on Monday. We begin with the coronavirus pandemic that continues to spread and take lives across our country. This week, we've had single days with more than 3,000 deaths recorded across the United States. In Vermont, we're becoming used to seeing around 100 new cases a day, and deaths are inching closer to 100, with 89 as of yesterday. Vermonters for months have been wearing masks, washing hands, keeping their distance, and recently limiting their interactions with others to try to contain the spread of the virus. But it continues to infect more people every day. Some of the people trying to rein in the spread of the virus are contact tracers with the Vermont Department of Health. They currently are working on dozens of cases, starting with individuals who've tested positive and then reaching out to the people who they might have exposed. Their job is literally trying to spread the word about new infections faster than the virus itself can spread. My guest this morning is Monica Talbot Ogilby from Waterbury, who works with the Department of Health as a contact tracing leader. We'll talk about how the process works and some of the new steps that contact tracers are taking to connect with people quicker. If you have a question about contact tracing, about being a close contact of someone who has tested positive for COVID-19, or even better, how to avoid being a close contact of someone with COVID, give us a call at 244-1777 or 1-877-291-8255. I think we have Monica Ogilby on the line.
Good morning.
Good morning, Monica. How are you?
I'm great, Lisa. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for taking the time. You must be super busy right now, and I really appreciate you taking a break to be able to talk with us this morning about the work that you and everyone at the health department is doing right now.
Happy to be here.
Awesome. Well, I thought maybe we could start with talking about how contact tracers do their work. They're not all in one big room someplace, right? I mean, I'm thinking maybe a lot of them are working at home, like a lot of other people are doing right now, and they are sort of getting assignments as to who they need to get in touch with, and they start making their calls.
Yeah, no, we once upon a time, we were all in a room together in early March at the health department in Vermont. In Burlington, but we realized quickly, like most of the general public, that that was really just not the safest practice. And so the health department, with the help from many others, helped stand up some technology so that people could be working remotely and doing this work remotely. And so our entire contact tracing team is now working remotely from homes, and I think probably a handful of them are still going into the office based on needs or preference, but certainly making sure that people are doing this as distanced and as safely as possible.
How many contact tracers roughly are there right now doing this work? It seems like the number of cases have just exploded in the last couple weeks, with like 100 or so every day. So I would think that the work is just kind of mushrooming right now.
Yeah. So, you know, we have a few different teams. We have a core team from the Vermont Department of Health that is mostly VDH employees. That make up, you know, I'm going to estimate here, there's probably about 40 or 50 that are trained and deployed there. Then we have roughly almost the same number, perhaps just a smidge less, from the National Guard, who've been incredible partners in this work. And then we have another team of people that are trained to make just calls to the contacts themselves. Mm-hmm. And sort of the number of people working at any time and is in flux, because it's really based on the need. So we have, you know, a core staff that are available to respond to the number of cases on any given basis. And then we have some people really on standby should we need additional support. And then there's also considerations about increasing capacity all the time. So we're actually training up to 15 new people a week in this work, and onboarding them through a process with our more seasoned veterans in this work. So we're constantly striving to build capacity and make sure that we have enough people to be doing this work so we can get in touch with Vermonters in a really timely manner.
Excellent. That sounds like it really needs a lot of logistics planning to know who's on what. One of the things that we hear when people are talking about being, you know, sort of alert for getting calls from the health department about, you know, contact tracing and the fact that they may have been in close proximity to someone who's tested is that we hear this messaging, especially from our schools, to be sure to answer the calls. You know, people are used to seeing phone numbers on their caller ID that aren't familiar and they might not answer. If people are working from all these different places, how do their phone numbers pop up? Has the technology been figured out so that it somehow displays that it's a state of Vermont or a health department number, or is it just kind of a random number that people might not recognize and may not want to answer?
Yeah, so the contact tracers use like an internet-based phone through their computers. So it will come up as Vermont Department of Health calling. It won't say anything specific to COVID. It will just say Vermont Department of Health. And, you know, that's because we take people's privacy incredibly seriously. So, you know, perhaps Vermont Department of Health is a giveaway. I certainly hope not. But Vermont Department of Health can be calling for a variety of reasons because we do so much work with the public and our partners. So it'll just say VDH or Vermont Department of Health. It won't say anything related to COVID, and because we don't, if someone oversees, you know, your cell phone ringing from VDH, we don't want it to say anything COVID specifically. So occasionally it might come up as no caller ID, and that's for a variety of different reasons. We have had some times where technology is limited, right? And we live in a place where sometimes internet service can be a touch fickle. So, you know, there have been times when I've had to use my work provided cell phone, and it will come up as no caller ID, but that's really pretty few and far between. That's just in an effort to keep the work flowing. And in those cases, you know, I'll leave a message and say, like most people, you know, I screen calls, but you may see another call come up from this number or a no caller ID number. It's me, Monica. I'm a nurse from the health department, and if you'd pick up, I'd appreciate it. And then usually people pick up the next time and say, sorry, I was screening my calls, which we understand.
Well, that's good to hear, because I was afraid that it may have just been sort of random numbers, and that would be even more confusing and lead for it to take a lot longer to get in touch with people. So I think if most people see Vermont Department of Health right now, given the time that we're in, they would think that that was pretty important. Yeah. And they would answer. And it sounds like you do leave messages, too. If for some reason you don't reach them on the first try, you let them know what it is that you're calling about.
Always, yeah. You know, we don't include details on the messages, and that's by design. So if anybody has ever, you know, gone to a doctor's office or the hospital, likely you've signed forms related to HIPAA, which is really a protection measure to make sure that nobody's ever disclosing your protected health information to those that don't need to know. So, you know, when we leave messages, we don't say we're calling to tell you that you're COVID positive or that you've been named as a contact. Generally, I just say, hi, this is Monica. I'm a nurse at the Vermont Department of Health. I'm trying to get in touch with you. I will give you a call back in the next 15 or 20 minutes or so, and hopefully we can touch base. So we generally don't leave any particulars on voicemails.
Okay, but it sounds like it's still enough information that people get that it's an important thing and they better, you know, pick up next time or call back if you're leaving a number. So one thing that I'm thinking about is in the course of our daily lives, I have a friend who's a nurse who says that she pays attention every day to where she goes and who she comes in contact with. Just in case there's the chance that she might have to, you know, kind of trace her steps backwards for a contact tracer. Is that something that all of us should be doing to some extent, to be sort of being, you know, aware and alert as to who we're coming in contact with and where we're, you know, going day to day in case we get one of these calls and we have to start listing things off? How far back do you have to go with people? Is it tough to get people to remember who they've been around?
Yeah, tell your friend that they are an exceptional steward of public health, and bravo. You know, when I was just testing my phone line here with the station, they asked me to say what I had for breakfast, right, just to test the sound. I had breakfast 90 minutes ago, and I couldn't remember. So I think that that's just sort of a product of people being inundated with information. I don't know that that's necessarily unique to me, or maybe it is, and I need to get that checked out. Either way, you know, I think keeping a log of your activities is incredibly smart during these times, you know, when, because it is really hard to remember where you were last week, and we ask incredibly detailed questions. So, you know, for example, when we find out that somebody is COVID-19 positive, we get lab feeds. So we get the actual lab data. So we're going to know when someone's specimen was collected, and we're going to know when that specimen was resulted, because sometimes, you know, there's some days between when the specimen is collected and when it's resulted. And then based on that result, the Vermont Department of Health lab gets that information, sends it out to the contact tracing team, and those investigations are opened and assigned to the team to start working on. And so when we're calling those people, you know, oftentimes it's already been some time since they got tested. And so something prompted them to get tested, either symptom onset or being named a contact of another individual. And so already, you know, a handful of days could have potentially passed. And so, you know, then we're going to be speaking to them about when their symptoms, if they're symptomatic, you know, when those started and what those looked like. And we're going to provide them with isolation guidance and make sure that they themselves are safe and have the tools that they need to isolate safely, including, you know, housing and food and cleaning supplies. We recognize that this is a really human process, and it's hard to tell people to be isolated in an already really isolated world. And so then, you know, we're going through that, and then we say, oh, and by the way, let's think back even further. You know, 2 days before those symptoms started, who were you in contact with? And then we have to dig into what contact means, and how we qualify contact and how we quantify that. And it's a lot of information. And so for the people that keep a record, you know, it definitely makes it a lot easier for them. And so, you know, we go through their texts. You know, or we don't, but we say, let's take a minute, you know, look at your phone, let's look at your text, let's look at your emails, let's look at your calendar, and let's see, you know, did you have a hair appointment? Did you have a dentist appointment? You know, did you go to church? You know, things like that. So it really helps us kind of, you know, create a picture of where they were, and if, you know, if during those whereabouts they were in close contact with anybody that we should be providing quarantine guidance to. So, you know, a log is really, really great, and, you know, it turns over. So, you know, roughly every 2 weeks, what happened greater than 2 weeks ago no longer matters.
Right. Those sound like some really good strategies to kind of help you remember where you've been and who you've been around, looking at your text messages and your calendars and stuff like that, because that may definitely jog people's memories that they didn't remember that they, you know, dropped off their kid, or they, you know, they had to stop it to pick up a gift or something at a store. And one of the things that we've heard is about, you know, whether you then become the contact that needs to either get tested or quarantine or both has to do with how long you might have been around somebody who tested positive and how close you were. And it talked, one of the guidances that the schools have talked about is how you need to have been within about 6 feet distance from someone for 15 minutes or more without a mask. Is that kind of the benchmarks that you look for?
Yeah, that's pretty close. So a close contact is defined as someone you were within 6 feet of for greater than 15 minutes in a 24-hour period. The mask part actually doesn't impact if you're considered a contact or not. That impacts our assessment of what the risk of transmission is in that moment. So if there are masks in place on one or both people, then the risk goes down significantly of transmission. Okay. But a close contact is defined 6 feet greater than 15 minutes within a 24-hour period.
Okay, great. And it looks like we have a caller. This morning we've got Henry on the line from Morrisville. Good morning, Henry.
Good morning. I just have a question.
Sure, go ahead.
Yesterday, I stopped at a place for gas. The guy got out of his car next to me. I wear a mask all the time. I'm very careful. The guy next to me got out of his car, no mask, went in the store. I started to go in the store to pay, opened the door. There was another guy in there at the counter, no mask. This guy was in there, no mask. The lady behind the counter, no mask. So I stayed outside. And when one of them came out, I went in and gave her money for gas, and the other guy left. And I said, they don't wear masks? And she said, well, it's their choice. And that's all she said. So I gave her money for gas and pumped my gas. I was on my way. Doesn't sound like that's a very good idea. What's your thought?
Well, I got to commend you, Henry, because you're taking care of yourself and you're doing the right things. And, quite frankly, I probably would have done the same thing. So keep wearing your mask and keeping your distance and staying outside when you can. I can't comment on some of the decisions made by, you know, business owners or employees. But, you know, I can say that, you know, we do have the ACCD here in Vermont, which is the Agency of Commerce and Community Development, who have been awesome partners in this work. And should you feel like you have concerns about practices in any certain, business in your community, they're a really great resource to connect with and to share your concerns. And potentially, you know, they'd be able to do some outreach and support that business and in understanding what the rules and regulations and recommendations are. But, you know, on a case-by-case basis, it sounds like you handled that really well. And I'm sorry you were confronted with that. It always feels a little uncomfortable.
You know,
okay.
One of the things, Henry, that we've been hearing on the governor's briefings every week are the different state officials who are, you know, fanning out around the state to help educate people about what the best practices are and stuff. People will ask about whether there's quote unquote enforcement and punishment, which the governor has been very reluctant to say that he wants to take that tack. His attitude has been to try to really encourage people to understand why this is important and why these practices are being recommended, and they, you know, if this is something that's flagged to them, that may be an opportunity for someone from ACCD or elsewhere from the health department, et cetera, to get in touch with that business to remind them and to explain why this is important. And maybe it isn't something that they can control for their customers coming in the door, but at least maybe their employees could be setting a good example and following the guidelines to model some good practices. Thanks for your call. So, Monica, one thing that you mentioned earlier at the beginning of your interview here was you mentioned how there's new contact tracers that are coming on board. One of the questions that came up in one of the briefings recently was that someone had been hearing about how people were asking how they could become a contact tracer. Is the state in a position right now where they are hiring new contact tracers? And if someone was, you know, in a position where maybe their work has allowed them to have extra time and they're interested in learning about this, is that something that people can apply for? And what is that? How does that work and what's involved?
Yeah, so that's a great question. There's a few recommendations I could make. Fortunately, in the role that I'm in as a clinical lead to the contact tracing team, I am very kindly buffered from the hiring process. But I can let you know that, you know, if you're interested or if you have questions about that, I don't know what our current status is of hiring since we are in the process of working with so many partners to onboard contact tracers. You can always call the health department and ask. 863-7240 is the COVID number there. The other thing is if you have a background and you feel like being part of the Medical Corps volunteers, that is an incredible opportunity. And you can go in there and you can sign up to be a volunteer. And that can, you know, pertain both to the COVID pandemic response right now, but then it's also a great thing for the future should the health department of the state of Vermont ever need volunteers to respond to a different crisis. So signing up to be a Medical Corps volunteer is an awesome gift to all of us.
That's great to know. That's something I didn't even know existed. Okay, another thing, too, that was sort of new this week that we heard from Dr. Levine on Tuesday was that he said that there was going to be another step that contact tracers were going to add into, their portfolio of how they're reaching people. And he talked about how they might start adding text messages as another way to try to reach people. So I guess if someone tests positive, they, you know, start, you know, jogging their memory as to who their contacts are and they share numbers. Has that started yet? Have you had a chance to give that a try? And I'm just wondering if that's, you know, going to be an effective way to kind of get people's attention.
Yeah, so it hasn't started yet, but I think it's going to start any moment, any day now. It's just a matter of ensuring that the technology is in a solid place so that we're not unintentionally confusing people and letting it loose too soon. We have been using text when as a tool in our toolkit to outreach people. So we have email to text technology that we can use. And we have found that it's been really effective with certain individuals for a variety of different reasons. And so as we've seen more appetite for texting for this type of work, you know, we've always wanted to keep it really personal and for Vermonters to know that another Vermonter is going to call them. And they'll still have that, you know, that human interaction. But we've found out that texts are kind of a great way to give people at least a heads up that something's going on and that we would recommend that they go home and quarantine and wait to hear from the health department. So I think it'll be great just to give people a heads up so that if they're out and about, that they know they need to go home and that they'll be hearing from us really shortly. I know that the anxiety of knowing the health department's going to call and wondering when that's going to happen is real. We hear that from people. They say, oh, yeah, I've been waiting for you. You know, even
right.
though it's not been that long, it might feel like a long time to us. It feels like a long time to other people that are expecting the call. So I think it's just nice for them to know, like, we're aware, we know you're there, and we're going to call you as soon as we possibly can.
That's great. That's a great way to get people's attention. And our time is up. We've been talking with Monica Ogilvie from the Vermont Department of Health about COVID-19 contact tracing. If you have any questions, needed more information about COVID-19, the health department's website is healthvermont.gov. You can find the latest data there on the health department's collecting. You can sign up to be tested. You can get tips on whether and how to quarantine and lots more information. Monica, thank you for taking your time this morning, and thanks for all the work that you and the folks at the health department are doing.
Hey, likewise. Thanks for having me.
We'll be back with more Vermont Viewpoint here on WDEV after this CBS News update.
Things are strange right now, but we are here for you at the Warren Store. Whether curbside or in-store, our newly renovated state-of-the-art deli will be putting out sandwiches, soups, salads, and grab-and-go meals. Check out our website for menus and hours. Lattes coming soon. New upstairs, Free People, Burt's Bees baby clothes, Tabitha Henry luminaries, holiday ornaments, cards, and much more. We hope to be online soon for your shopping convenience. Stay safe, follow the governor's guidelines, and have a healthy, happy holiday season. Fun, funky, and friendly, the Warren Store. Main Street, Warren Village.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Lisa Scalotti in for Rick Sangari this morning. He'll be back on Monday. When we look back on 2020, for many of us, Town Meeting Day back in March, remember Super Tuesday? That might have been the last public gathering many of us attended before everything stopped because of COVID-19. On the calendar, Town Meeting Day 2021 is March 2. And that'll be here before we know it. But despite news of vaccines getting rolled out soon across the country, that's going to take a while. And people will need to likely continue wearing masks and avoid close contact with others, especially gatherings, well into 2021. In Vermont, we've had several very successful elections during this pandemic. But how will Town Meeting Day work for the many communities that still rely on annual in-person public meetings to discuss and vote on important business like town and school budgets? State legislators and elections officials, town clerks, select boards, and town managers are all planning for this right now. With me this morning is Will Senning, who heads the Elections Division of the Vermont Secretary of State's office. I'm hoping he can fill us in on how plans for Town Meeting Day 2021 are shaping up already. If you'd like to ask a question or offer a comment, give us a call here at WDEV at 244-1777 or 1-877-291-8255. Good morning, Will. It's nice to have you with us.
Good morning, Lisa. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be on.
Well, you know, we've got some elections in the rearview mirror for 2020, but there's another one coming right down the pike, right?
That's right. No rest for the weary.
Before the legislature wrapped up their session in the fall, they passed one last bill that looked ahead to Town Meeting Day. And it made some allowances for how towns might have a little bit of leeway and some options to handle town meeting in 2021. Do you think you can maybe start there and explain what measures they put in place that will give town select boards and town officials, town clerks, the tools that they might need to accommodate and adapt for the pandemic and town meeting?
Sure. And if I can, I'll take one step back before that, too. To just point out and say, sort of set the table for that, that the various legislative changes that were implemented last spring, in the spring of 2020, as the virus was ramping up for everybody, all expire at the end of this year. So the authority that was granted to the Secretary of State's office to come up with new procedures as necessary last year expires at the end of this year, as do some of the legislative changes that were made last spring, allowing modifications to procedures. So really, as of January 1st, without anything else, we would be kind of back at square one and back at the standard laws under Title 17 that govern elections.
Okay, so they had to take some action then, knowing that this was going to take extend longer into the new year to make some allowances.
Exactly.
Gotcha.
And from their remote position in the session in the fall, the last bill that they passed, actually, I think, was Act 162. And it did two primary things for the upcoming annual meetings for 2021. The first is that it allows the legislative body of a municipality, so that's your select board in the case of a town or city council or school board for a school district, mm-hmm. trustees for a village, it allows those legislative bodies to decide to conduct the meetings, all articles for the annual meetings this year, by an Australian ballot system. I'll get back to that in a second. The second primary provision in that bill was waiving the requirement for candidates for local office to collect signatures on a petition.
Well, those are two definite steps to, you know, move things to look differently pretty quickly. Because normally if a town wanted to change the way that it handles town meeting to go from an in-person meeting to voting everything by Australian ballot or paper ballot, you'd have to have the whole town vote on that. And in this case, it sounds like a city council or a select board could just make that decision.
That's right. And as the law is structured, you know, in the standard form, the vote to move to an Australian ballot happens at one meeting and then doesn't apply until the next meeting, which needs its own 30-day warning, or you're talking about waiting until the next annual meeting. So allowing the legislative body to do it this way allows them to adopt it right now and implement it right away at this upcoming annual meeting.
And if they do this, would this change it forever, or would that they have to go back and undo it, or is it just for 2021?
No, good question. The way that legislation's read is that it's just for 2021, and when you get to the annual meetings in 2022, you would be back to the approach you typically use. And then it would again require a vote of the voters to move back to an Australian ballot.
So I was thinking about this in terms of how different municipalities handled town meeting. Town meeting's one of my favorite days of the year in Vermont. I love covering town meeting and going to town meetings. But there's already a handful of cities and municipalities that don't do an in-person meeting. Like some of the larger communities like Burlington, South Burlington, they already have all their business on Australian ballot, and people just basically vote on town meeting day. So for those places, those communities, that really wouldn't change much, right?
That's right. For those that typically do it, it's pretty much business as usual. The point being that they don't face the same risk of these floor meetings that are really a gathering of many people in a confined space that present the biggest risk this year.
Right. So then if you're a community that does some of your business in an in-person meeting, that's usually like a school gym, a town hall, and oftentimes the important things that get decided there are like the town budget, and people can make motions and they can tweak the line items in a budget. They can ask questions. They can delete things, add things. Sometimes it could be a very long process. There won't be an option if it goes to Australian ballot to make any changes. So when your select board comes up with their budget in January to put things on the ballot, that's it. That will be what people end up voting on.
That's right. And that's why I think sort of part of the general guidance that's been going out there to voters who are concerned about that is to get engaged now and get engaged early with your select boards as they're coming up with that budget number. At the next couple meetings.
That's good advice. That often gets lost in the rush of the holidays and everything, where select boards, city council, school boards, they're all getting started now, if they haven't already, going over their drafts and starting to put their budgets together, because I think the deadline for them to have their final budgets to go to the voters all wrapped up is somewhere around the end of January, right?
That's right. Yep. The warning for the meetings, for the annual meeting, the last day to post that warning is January 31st.
Okay.
So they would need to have that budget number available at that time.
One thing I'm hearing in conversations with select boards is that they're discussing and tossing around the ideas of having they're already meeting themselves on Zoom. School boards are meeting on Zoom or YouTube or some combination of sort of video conferencing. They're kicking around the ideas of having maybe informational meetings that are video conferences that the public could dial into and participate to ask questions and sort of get the general overview before they vote. Is there anything stopping municipalities from doing that if it's a situation where there's no decision-making happening, but it's just an informational kind of thing?
No, that's a good point and a good reminder for everyone that two things. That one, that informational meeting, if you decide to use an Australian ballot system this year, the law requires you to hold one of these informational hearings, and it's required within the 10 days before the vote. It's sort of meant to be the median to give a little chance at least for discussion of the articles and awareness of them before you cast your ballot. But those meetings, like you pointed out, are hosted by, they're a meeting of the legislative body, and so they are able to be conducted remotely this year. Under emergency provisions, actually you go back to last spring when the legislature put in their first emergency provisions, they added language to the open meeting law that governs those meetings of public bodies, allowing them to be conducted remotely. And so that applies to these informational meetings coming up.
Well, and I think by now, too, and especially by the time 10 days before the election, we're talking like, you know, mid to late February, people, I think, are really getting into this new routine with doing a lot of things online, a lot of meetings online. I've attended many meetings so far with school boards and select boards in the last 6 or so months where the participation has been really good as far as people logging in from home to pay attention to a select board meeting or a school board meeting. In some ways, people are kind of getting accustomed to this technology and gathering this way. And so I think by the time town meeting rolls around, it might not be that much of a leap to expect people to tune in that way. Oftentimes, the informational meetings that are in person before town meeting get very few people.
I think that's right. And, just anecdotally across the board in all kinds of contexts, I think this need to be doing things remotely has in a lot of ways opened up transparency into these public bodies and given a lot more people the opportunity to observe and participate, and that's a good thing.
Some people say that they think maybe even after the pandemic is over that they might like to try to keep that option as a way for people to pay attention to their select boards and school boards. So maybe it'll become more of a routine going forward even when this is all over.
I wouldn't be surprised.
Well, I would like to get back to the idea of how towns have options right now as far as handling their in-person town meetings. If they can't meet indoors and have in-person gatherings and the option is to just switch everything to a paper ballot, is there any other option that they might be able to pursue? I had an interesting conversation by email yesterday with Susan Clark, who's a co-author of the book All Those in Favor with UVM Professor Frank Bryan, and I asked her if she had any background as to how they handled the pandemic town meeting in 1919, back when the influenza pandemic was happening, and she didn't really have a lot of insight into that. She thought it had probably burned out by then, but she pointed out that down in Massachusetts in earlier this year, they had a option where towns were able to do their town meetings outside and they just postponed them into the spring. Is there any chance that maybe that might be something that happens here in Vermont?
Yeah, I think there is. That gives me a good chance to touch on something I wanted to. For instance, when, again, last year, going back to last spring, the legislature gave the Secretary of State the authority to implement some or permit some new procedures for local elections. A few of the things that our office did allow included holding the meeting outside and holding the meeting by a drive-through method. And a fair number of towns took advantage of both of those. As of now, again, as I pointed out at the beginning, because sort of the slate is cleared again as of January 1st, that's not authorized right now. And so to answer your first question, really the only options on the plate right now are to move to the Australian ballot system. However, I am aware the legislature is working on providing more options, and they're aware that that would have to happen right away in the first couple weeks of the session. And two of the things they're talking about is, one, permitting towns and municipalities to cancel, postpone the meetings until later in the spring. And I know there's a lot of interest out there, just as you described, that they could postpone and then perhaps hold the floor meeting outdoors. They're also discussing permitting and allowing towns to mail ballots to all active registered voters, like you did for the general election. And then they are also considering reauthorizing the secretary's authority to authorize and permit some of those procedures. And if they were to do so, I would think that pretty shortly thereafter we would reauthorize through that authority the drive-up or the outdoor methods.
Well, that'll definitely be something to keep an eye on as the legislature gets into session in January, and people should probably, if they have strong feelings about that, let their legislators know, what they might like to see. I know we saw that here right in Duxbury. They did drive-through voting for the all three elections that they had in 2020, with the school budget vote, the primary, and the general election, and that seemed to go really smoothly in the voting process part of it. Having a meeting outside sounds like a pretty pleasant thing once the weather gets nice. So that'll be definitely something to keep an eye on. You mentioned ballots.
That gives me a chance to be clear about something I wanted to, which is that this authority that they've already granted to move to an Australian ballot system doesn't include the authority to mail those ballots proactively to all voters. So the towns that implement this Australian ballot for this year, at least as of right now, will be doing so on a request-based method where voters are required to request a ballot before it's sent to them.
Okay, that's good to know. So if people want to be able to vote early, or they want to be able to vote to just drop it off or mail it in, they have to actually request that ballot from their town clerk the way things stand right now. That would be a lot of mailing, because in the 2020 elections, the Secretary of State handled all that mailing. The town clerks were not the ones on the hook to do all of that.
Correct, which is different for these local elections.
Right, that would be harder. One thing that seems easier is the fact that people can actually get on the ballot as a candidate, though, without signatures. So maybe that'll encourage more people to run for office.
It definitely could. I think we lifted the signature requirement also last year for candidates to get on the primary ballots. And we did see an uptick, but actually not as big of an uptick as I expected. Outside of the presidential race, we had about the same number of candidates that we usually have running for those offices.
Interesting. Well, we'll see if that makes a difference for the select boards and school boards and all those spots that are going to be open in March. We're just about out of time here, and so I wanted to ask, as far as if people want more information about how their town meeting is going to work in their town, at this point, it seems like this is going to be decided on a town-by-town basis, so their own town clerk's offices, the websites for their town offices, that's probably where people should be getting the most up-to-date information then, right?
Exactly, and or their select boards.
Right.
Yep.
Right. Awesome. Well, at this point, we're going to have to call it that, and we'll pay attention to what the legislature does in January. Thank you, Will Senning, Director of Elections for the state of Vermont. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. We'll be back after the CBS News break.
Things are strange right now, but we are here for you at the Warren Store. Whether curbside or in-store, our newly renovated state-of-the-art deli will be putting out sandwiches, soups, salads, and grab-and-go meals. Check out our website for menus and hours. Lattes coming soon. New upstairs, Free People, Burt's Bees baby clothes, Tabitha Henry luminaries, holiday ornaments, cards, and much more. We hope to be online soon for your shopping convenience. Stay safe, follow the governor's guidelines, and have a healthy, happy holiday season. Fun, funky, and friendly, the Warren Store. Main Street, Warren Village.
We're back with Vermont Viewpoint, and I'm Lisa Scalotti with the news site WaterburyRoundabout.org. I'm sitting in for Rick Sangari today, and he returns on Monday. Now it's time for Friday morning's update on top stories from around the world and around the nation with CBS News correspondent Bob Ney in Washington, D.C. Good morning, Bob.
Hey, good morning, Lisa. How are you?
Great. It's nice to talk to you, not just hear you on the radio this morning.
You too.
It looks like there's so much happening. It's a really busy Friday as I sort of scroll through the internet and see what some of the headlines are all around. And it just looks like no matter where you go, COVID is a big story all across the world today.
It is. And, of course, the rollout is going on as we speak in the United Kingdom. Israel is planning its rollout December 27th. And here in the United States, by a vote that occurred, yesterday, 17-4, the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, as everybody knows it, has approved Pfizer and BioNTech's coronavirus vaccine. And that means, of course, the secondary debate that's going to come out is how do you move it out, who gets it first, and how do you get it to the general population?
It's going to be a logistical, nightmare maybe, but just quite a feat to see this just get deployed across the country. I saw charts the other day that showed FedEx and UPS dividing the country as far as, you know, who was going to be handling these shipments and the refrigeration that's going to be required and the tracking chips that are in each of these vaccine packages, et cetera, and that they have the military involved essentially to try to, you know, handle all the coordination of this.
Right, and it requires it to be 91 degrees minus Fahrenheit, and then once it is taken to the places that, you know, transmit the vaccine out to the public, like, you know, whatever pharmacies or hospitals or whatever, then it has a 5-day shelf life after it de-thaws. So that all has to be taken in consideration. And UPS and FedEx, which I know pretty well how they operate, right now are out there in the holiday season begging for people to work as helpers, so you can bet when they undertake this, they're going to have to go out and get a temporary workforce and the military coordinating with them. So you're right, there is a lot to this. It's going to be the biggest rollout, of course, in American history.
Wow. And, you know, and other countries are doing the same thing. So I just wonder how much, and sort of like the really big picture, if there's anyone who's really kind of looking at this across the board to see if there's sort of commonalities that can be found, I guess, from one region of the world to another as to how things will work.
Well, you raise a great point because you actually raise a point that somebody should have said in the authority of government already, which they haven't, because it's sometimes the government doesn't act on things like it should. But the point you make is so true. I hope, and I don't know that they are or aren't, that the United States government and other governments are all talking worldwide about how this goes, because they can learn from each other and it'll help save some people's lives.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if everybody's going to basically be trying to solve the same problem in real time, and hopefully they're going to be communicating with one another. I see there's progress a little bit ahead of us in Canada as well. And so, you know, they're our neighbor pretty close by, and maybe I don't think it's going to be minus 91 in Canada this winter, so they're going to have to do a lot of this, a lot of the same logistics and refrigeration, et cetera, that we're going to have to do here. That also brings up the other question, though, too, as far as the impacts, because this is going to take a while before everyone actually has access to the vaccine. They're going to be focusing on healthcare workers and the really more susceptible people in the population first. So there still is going to be the need for people to be distancing and wearing masks and being careful and all of that. And it still means that there's probably going to be a lot of businesses that are impacted, and the whole question about the COVID relief package in Congress right now is still hanging over Congress as they head into the Christmas holiday.
Well, that's right, Lisa. And, you know, just as fast and efficiently as the FDA panel approved the vaccine, Congress is going in the other direction when it comes to two things: the imminent government shutdown, which they'll extend temporarily for a week till they can deal with it, but also the COVID relief package and, you know, the stimulus package. Everything that they have to deal with in that has just, as of today at least, virtually collapsed. And, I would hope that they, and I think people in the country hope that they do something. So right now that doesn't look like it's on the good side.
And aren't a lot of the efforts right now that have been put in place expiring at the end of the month?
Well, yes, and in fact, the Trump administration actually hurried that along because the Secretary of the Treasury, Mnuchin, actually canceled some of the programs instead of letting them run and return money to the Treasury. About,
I don't know, 400 some billion potentially, which people may say is good, but they could have actually left them open. Now they'll have to be reconstituted by the Biden administration if they want them. So, you know, that's another snag to this. And some of them do expire. Yes, that's correct.
Boy, this is just a bad time of year for all of these things to be kind of hitting the fan at once. Mm-hmm. Anyhow, you're in Washington. Are you seeing plans for the inauguration coming together? Are there is there signs of that around, or is it looking like it's going to be a pretty low-key affair?
Well, they're going to hurry. I've been to several. I'm in Ohio today, but I have been to several of the inaugurals, and the ones that I knew of in the last 24 years kind of went the regular pattern. This one got delayed, you know, for a lot of reasons.
Right.
But they have a lot of people, a lot of history, a lot of experts. They'll get it done. Now, I guess the question I would ask is, are they going to have? What about spacing, you know? They might have the most different inaugural we've seen in a long, long time.
I know. That's going to be really interesting to see how they put all that together.
Right.
Turning to the international headlines, what are you seeing out there today as far as some of the interesting things happening around the world? I saw this interesting story that you brought up out of Morocco.
Well, you know, Morocco is, it's below the radar, I call it, because of everything else going on. Morocco for years has tried to get the United States to recognize it in this fight with African nations on the sub-Sahara desert, Western Sahara. And the United States, we are the only Western country that did this. We recognize that they have a right to the desert. Morocco does. And they, in turn, are going to establish diplomatic relations with Israel, was the trade-off. But also, it's not in the story, but 72% of the world's phosphates are there. So somebody asked, well, what's Morocco get? Well, by the United States supporting it, it may get more support, and it would control 72% of those phosphates, which are used, you know, for fertilizer and a lot of other products. So there's usually some money at stake somewhere in these ball games, Lisa, and
absolutely.
I think that's what it is.
Uh-huh. That's interesting, and it definitely is below the radar. There are
yes.
so many other things getting attention right now,
right.
And that could just end up sneaking past, and we'll see how the what the fallout's going to be from that as that moves ahead. The other more, I guess, the more prominent story over in Europe is what's happening on the Brexit front.
Oh, yes. That's another one. You know, this has been back and forth. And, of course, one of the prime ministers, you know, grew out of favor over Brexit. And then Johnson came in and he said he would solve it. Well, right now, the European Union and United Kingdom are bracing for no exit. Deal again, no exit on Brexit, you know, and so they've got a lot of measures they're going to try to put in temporarily of being able to have communications going between the European Union and use of roadways and visas and everything else under the sun, but it doesn't look good. It didn't reach what it was supposed to, which was an agreement with the European Union and England.
Wow. And at this point, it seems as if with travel restricted, it's not like there's a lot of people who are traveling back and forth as far as impacts here that Americans might see. But I'm sure a lot of American businesses are watching this, trying to figure out which end is up and how that's going to affect their companies.
They sure are. And, you know, supply chains of products and driving the trucks between countries and then some of those products end up over here. I mean, there's a whole, you know, big world that's a small world when it comes to supply chains and the ties to each other.
I mean, it looks like even just travel between England and Ireland right now is complicated.
Right, it is. Shouldn't be, but it is.
Right.
And again, it failed, and everybody thought they would have something by now, but right now they're on the cliff when it comes to trying to do something. So it's all going to be temporary until they can try to figure out what to do.
Okay, so they've got that going on. We've got a potential government shutdown. It's just situation normal everywhere, right?
That's it.
So one other headline I wanted to ask you about is there's this situation over in China having to do with a Bloomberg News staffer that's been detained. What's that all about?
Well, this is like a slap back at us is what it is. China is saying, okay, we're detaining, her name is Heize Fan, a Chinese national and also a news staffer working for the Beijing Bureau of Bloomberg. And, they've also in Hong Kong went after a tycoon, an entrepreneur over there, that, you know, has been pro-democracy. China did that, too. He's a media tycoon. And they're doing this because, you know, they're trying to obviously control what's said. China had a lot of problems over here in the United States with some of their journalists that really weren't journalists but were active, you know, people that we suspicioned would be involved in spying. And then, of course, there's a less spy that is went back to China, and her name is Fang, and she's been looked at. She tried to get people in congressional offices. So all this is going down. China's been pressured all over the world. And so now they're reacting, saying, fine, we're going to go after your news service people because we went after theirs. So China's a very aggressive type of government, and I think they're showing it with what they're doing.
Well, this looks pretty concerning, too. It's not really clear as to how where she's being detained, how she's being held,
right,
et cetera. It'll be interesting to see if the United States government ends up giving any support to Bloomberg News as they try to navigate this really
Correct.
Touchy situation.
Good point.
Wow.
Right.
Boy, so I guess we'll check back with you next week.
Okay.
At this rate, keep an eye on things for us, especially how things
okay.
are going back in D.C. as the fights continue here. Maybe there'll be some holiday breakthrough that changes people's minds with this COVID.
Maybe.
With this COVID
nice
package.
Talking to you, Lisa.
Thank you so much, Bob, for
Thank
highlighting
you.
All these stories today.
Thank you.
In a former lifetime, I first knew him as a newspaper editor, but for some 20 or so years now, Stephen Kiernan's life has been all about books. He's an author of 2 nonfiction titles and 4 novels. Stephen Kiernan also spends a lot of time reading. He told Sally Pollock in 7 Days recently that he reads something like 70 to 100 books a year. Let me do the math. That's a book or two a week. So it's no surprise that he's kind of a human search engine for book suggestions, especially when it comes to giving gifts. And this is the time of year when Kiernan takes a little break from reading books to reading his Facebook posts from friends and fans who write asking for help choosing books to give as gifts, often for people who say they don't even like to read. Kiernan considers it a challenge, and he invites people to try to stump him. He joins us today to talk about this book matchmaking that he does and to take your calls for book recommendations. So grab your list and check it twice. Find that person with nothing next to their name yet and give us a call here at WDEV at 244-1777 or 1-877-291-8255. Stephen, welcome, and thanks for coming to talk books today.
Lisa, it's great to chat with you on WDEV. How fun is that? Howdy.
Yeah, exactly. You know, you're across the miles. It'd be nice to have you here in the studio, but I'm sure you've got a nice window over there in Charlotte to see what the morning is like, and we can do this remotely.
No. Yeah. This is a COVID call. It's how we live now.
Exactly. But, you know, I think that's part of why it's sort of a good thing to talk about this now, too, right? I mean, people are going into the holidays. You're going to try to make things as normal as possible. But we're not shopping like we normally shop, I think. Right?
Right.
And so
right.
people need some direction, maybe. We're not spending a lot of time in stores just wandering around or looking for ideas. People are kind of going out with a purpose. But they might need a little help.
It's true, and I think this is an easy year to get stumped, because what happens is you go into a store and you're thinking about your sister-in-law, you know, and what are you going to get her, and you wander around the place, and bingo, you see something. And if you're sitting at home, it's a lot harder to generate ideas. And as you can tell, I've got a sister-in-law I'm struggling to get a gift for. And pretty much, you know, a book is like an unexciting thing to unwrap. Right? It's just this kind of rectangle. But if it's any good, within a few pages, the pleasure comes to somebody. And when they get to the end, you know, you get a different kind of thank you if they've had a cool or funny or moving or engaging experience. And so it turns out to be kind of a gift that gives over a span of time rather than just in a moment. And so, I don't know, 4 years ago, I started posting on Facebook if people wanted suggestions, you know, I'd be happy to advise them. And now those folks come back every year. And I don't know, I've had hundreds of requests this year. People are really looking for books. And a thing I've added is, and we can talk more about this maybe, but I've done more connecting people with their local independent bookstore too, because, you know, retail is really suffering these days. And so there's a way that we can maybe play matchmaker on finding the right book for the right reader, and also help our communities. stay That's strong awesome. In a hard time.
Bookstores, all small retailers right now are hurting, and it hasn't helped with, you know, people being reluctant to go out, but there's also limitations on how many people can be inside stores. So people kind of go in and they don't want to take too much time. And, you know, it's risky being out and about, I suppose. So they're really trying to battle against, you know, people's reluctance to come in and their need to, you know, pay people to run the shops, et cetera. And the other thing too is that this pandemic started, if we think about it, right, it started back in March. As the weather got nicer and we got outside more, and now we're kind of on the flip side of this whole thing, right? Where now we're going into the wintertime where we're probably going to be indoors a lot more. I'm sure lots of people will be out doing recreational things, but you can't stay outside forever. So there's going to be a lot more inside time sitting by the wood stove or the fire. And so books just kind of lend themselves, I think, to the next few months of what we're still all going to have to endure with the you know, distancing, et cetera.
An interesting experience, I guess 2 days ago, maybe 3 days ago, I was down in Middlebury and I went by the Vermont Bookshop because I was looking for a particular title. And there's Becky Dayton, the owner, who's, you know, kept it going. There's been a lot of construction in the middle of Middlebury. It's sort of slowed traffic through town and that kind of thing. They've definitely had an ordeal. And she's kept very busy by a lot of the online ads, you know, the emails that she gets with people looking for books and so on. While I'm there, I'm just skimming around, seeing what's new, which is a thing I love to do. And a guy comes in, and he's doing the same thing, but he's not wearing a mask.
Mm.
And Becky says to him, sir, I'm sorry, but you have to wear a mask. And he says, well, I don't have one. And she points, and she's got, right when you come in the door, there's like a little hand sanitizer station, and there's, you know, a 50 mask hanging from it right there. And he walks toward it, and walks right by it and goes out the door. Now, I don't know if that guy was going to buy a book or not, but I think, like, if I were a retailer, you know, there were only a few other people in the store, I'd be tearing my hair out. And meanwhile, there is the appetite that is a very human appetite for story and for all kinds of stories.
Right.
And, you know, and people who say they don't read, which is often, yes, when people on Facebook say, I needed a suggestion for this person who doesn't read, the next year, these people come back and say, he loved X book. What can I get him this year? But it turns out it's just that they haven't been connected with the right title.
Well, one thing I like about your approach to this is that you ask people about the person who's going to be receiving the book, and you want to know about them a little bit. And I like that idea because I think that's a big half of it. A lot of times we like to give books that we ourselves like, right? I read a great book and I want my friend to read it. I want my sister to read it or my mom to read it. But they might not have the same taste that I do. Or they may not have the same opinion. It might be disappointing after they read the book that they'd be like, yeah, that didn't do it for me or I didn't finish it. And so, you know, I often will go and buy a pile of books that I like or that speak to me. And then I try to match them up with people on my list. I end up keeping half of them. But the idea of tuning into that person and trying to find the story that you think is going to speak to them is the key hook that you've got going here.
So far this year, the range of ages for requests I've had are a woman is 101, and she wants no sex, drugs, or rock and roll in hers.
Oh, my goodness.
And I just know this charming, charming, charming novel by Rachel Joyce called The Unlikely Pilgrimage of Harold Fry. And this woman is going to be absolutely delighted by this thoroughly charming story that is also very heartwarming. And on the flip side, the youngest I've had is 10-year-old boy who's a precocious reader, and he likes a great yarn. And I connected him with his mom with the Gerald Morris series of kind of comic retelling of the King Arthur legends.
Youngster.
And I remember like reading those with my sons, and they're really funny, in addition to being great Arthurian legend stuff. And so, you know, that range of, I mean, look, the book is a really interesting technology. It's an interesting invention, you know, because it can serve so many kinds of people. It's very portable. It's actually pretty inexpensive. You know, you think of it as two movies. It's really not very much, you know. And there's such a range, 52,000 books published in the United States every year. That's 1,000 a week, you know? So it's a matter of finding, like, what is really just right.
It's a needle in a haystack. Hold that thought. So we're going to take a break here in a minute for some CBS News break, and then we're going to be back hopefully with some callers who can give us a ring here at 244-1777, 1-877-291-8255. Give us a call. Let's ask Stephen for some suggestions for books that we might like to purchase for the holiday season. We'll be back with more Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV after the CBS News update.
Things are strange right now, but we are here for you at the Warren Store. Whether curbside or in-store, our newly renovated state-of-the-art deli will be putting out sandwiches, soups, salads, and grab-and-go meals. Check out our website for menus and hours. Lattes coming soon. New upstairs, Free People, Burt's Bees baby clothes, Tabitha Henry luminaries, holiday ornaments, cards, and much more. We hope to be online soon for your shopping convenience. Stay safe, follow the governor's guidelines, and have a healthy, happy holiday season. Fun, funky, and friendly, the Warren Store. Main Street, Warren Village.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Lisa Scolodi talking with Vermont author Stephen Kiernan, who's a firm believer that there's a book out there for everyone if you take the time to think about the reader and the story. Is there a reader on your holiday gift list that you want to surprise with something new, or someone who's tough to buy for but would love to find a book they might enjoy? Give us a call here this morning at 244-1777 or 1-877-291-8255. We have a caller on the line now who's just down the street from me here in Waterbury. Katya D'Angelo is the new owner of Bridgeside Books Independent Bookstore here in Waterbury, along with her husband, Chris. They just took over this fall. And so this is her first holiday season going into being a bookseller. Welcome, hit the ground running as a pandemic retailer, small business owner, Katya.
Thank you, Lisa. Yeah, it's been quite a ride the last few weeks or so, but nothing like jumping right in.
No, you know, I really wished, I know Stephen doesn't like to plug his books that much, but he had a book come out this year, and I really was hoping that he would have visited Waterbury to do a little, book reading and meeting and greeting with people here at the bookstore, which he had done back when his other earlier book, The Baker Seeker, came out a couple of years ago. But there was no book tour. Maybe there was a virtual book tour, Stephen, right?
Yeah, but it was in August. And really, who's going to give up an hour of an August evening to listen to me? Katya, it's very nice to meet you. And I have had an event at that store before for The Baker Seeker, and it was absolutely terrific. And I wish you all good luck. And I have a question. I mentioned this to Lisa, but, you know, you are Katya and she's Lisa. And I'm just wondering if to be like a person who stands out or some kind of a leader in the Waterbury community, is it necessary that you be female and your name end with the letter A? I'm just wondering. Since Hayata was the last book owners.
The Italian, I don't know, the Italian genes, we both have Italian last names. That helps too, probably.
I know. There might be something to that. We'll have to investigate that. We'll ask Nina, who owns the flower shop around downtown,
yeah,
too,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly my point.
We'll have more examples. But Katya, what are you seeing so far? I mean, have people started their shopping? We've got some promos happening here in town. This whole the annual Wrap It Up and Win thing is a promo that Revitalizing Waterbury does to get people to shop local. Are people coming into the store to look around, or are they coming in with, like, you know, Stephen's Facebook list saying, I need all these books?
It's really both. The one thing about small independent bookstores is that it's really a joy and a pleasure to be in kind of a cozy space surrounded by books. And people really love the browsing experience. And even with the pandemic, people are very mindful of spacing, which has been great. But they still want to just, you know, walk around and discover a book they might not have heard about or seen before and, you know, pull it off the shelf. And they're like, oh, that looks interesting. So there's plenty of that still going on. And I have to say, people have been awesome about mask wearing and sanitizing when they come in. And so I'm really grateful for everyone, for doing that. And then we have like a record number of special orders as well. So our shelves behind the counter are packed full. If you have a special order, please come pick it up. And people are walking in with, you know, a list or very specific requests. And if I don't have it in the store, I can, you know, typically get it in about 3 days. That's starting to get a little longer as we near towards Christmas. So the deadline for special orders is going to be Monday to ensure that you can pick it up before Christmas.
I was wondering about that, how you're finding the shipping process working right now, if it's the usual kind of speed or if it's slower than usual, you think.
Yeah, it's slowing down for sure. And there are, you know, they're lumping orders. So, you know, if I place an order on a Tuesday and then a Thursday, they're kind of waiting and they'll ship both on Thursday or Friday, you know. Mm. So it's kind of all over the place, but I'm still getting books in. In fact, I had a 26 box delivery yesterday from UPS.
Nice. Nice.
That I'm
great.
Still unpacking.
I'm trying to picture where you would put 26 boxes. Your shop is definitely cozy, as you put it, especially if you have a lot of things already out.
Creatively, let me say that.
Oh, goodness.
Well, the best thing we can do is get some of those books out the door, right? And, you know,
yes.
I'm hoping for a challenge, Lisa. I'm hoping somebody's going to call in and give me a really tough one to, you know, I've had some good challenges online this year. I hope a couple of your callers will try and stump the panel.
Well, one thing I remember you saying that you actually did a little bit of book selling yourself, Stephen, that you did some a couple shifts with Phoenix Books and the Flying Pig, where you would spend some time at the holidays being like a roving bookseller in the store.
It's more than that. But yeah, so the Saturday after Thanksgiving is called, you know, Small Business Saturday. And what bookstores often do is have writers come in and be guest booksellers. And my experience is somebody would come in and they were looking for, you know, a gentleman in Moscow, you know, and they pick it up. And I'd say, well, who else is on your list? And they begin to list off people. And this is actually where this started. And I did it, yes, at Phoenix in Burlington, at the Flying Pig in Shelburne, and at Vermont Bookshop in Middlebury. And you know, you'd see somebody walk out with six books instead of one. And the bookseller liked it, but the customer loved it, because they really could kind of take care of their list.
Well, see, that's what Katya was just talking about, right, in terms of like how people come in and they might come in for one thing, but then they leave with a bunch of others that they find when they're there.
The other part that makes me sort of irrepressible about this is that for a while, for 2 years, I lived in the Midwest and I worked at one of, you know, the great American bookstores, right? There are, I don't know, maybe 10 of them, fantastic, fantastic bookstores in the country, Tattered Cover and L.A. Bay and Powell's and so on. And I worked at Prairie Lights for a while and loved it, loved working in a bookstore. And my favorite thing about it was that I was literally working the register. You know, I was like next to the door in case someone tried to shoplift, sort of thing. And so the customers always assumed that I hadn't read anything. And so they put, you know, 100 Years of Solitude on the counter and say, you know, do you think I would like this? And I would say, well, you know, it's much more mainstream than you know, Irendira or you know, the Patriarch, you know, but it's not as good as The General in His Labyrinth or really, you know, Memoirs of My Melancholy Horrors. You know, I've read everything.
And then their eyes bug out at you.
They would just be like, I thought you were just going to like ring me up and swipe my card. So that's like a little, you know, so that's part of the fun for me about this is because I love to read, wanting to connect people with, you know, the great graphic novel of the year, the great book of poems, the, you know, the best thriller, or a book that will make them laugh out loud.
That's awesome. And, you know, one thing that Katya has going in her store right now, talk about, you know, hooking people, is that she's got a program right now that's running. It's been a tradition at Bridgeside that predates her, but she's continuing it this year. And it's a way to maybe basically hook some new readers, too. Right, Katya, with the Giving Tree Christmas program that you have? Oh, I'm sorry. We've lost Katya. She's already gone. Well, I can tell you about
she's
it
so
then.
She's so shy, you know?
She
that
is.
Katya is so shy.
It's okay. So here's the deal. At Bridgeside Books, they have this cool thing in their corner. It's a tree. And they have a 20% discount for people to come into the store. And they can buy children's books. And so if you buy a children's book, you get a discount and you put it under the tree. And the nonprofit organization called the Children's Literacy Foundation, which is based here in Waterbury, they collect these books that are then distributed to low-income, at-risk kids in rural places in Vermont, New Hampshire. Last year, they collected over 500 books. So
nice.
That's another thing that you could do while you're in there shopping. You could add a kid's book onto your pile of books that you're grabbing and stick one under the tree, and then that's going to go to a young reader, and they're for kids, you know, from age 2 up. So that's another opportunity that people have.
That's a really meaningful thing, Lisa. I remember years ago when David Walk was Commissioner of Education, he told me that the number one predictor of academic success is whether or not a child has been read to by a parent.
Exactly.
And children's books are really, really important from Pat the Bunny on forward. It's really a valuable thing for parent and child and that kid's long-term educational success. And I can imagine that sounds like a great good deed program the bookstore can enjoy and also the community can enjoy.
It is. And Cliff has been doing some great work this year. They do a lot of in-person events, so a lot of what they do has changed in terms of how they go out to distribute these books. But I read something from them recently where they still have been handing out record numbers of books to kids for similar reasons that adults are reading during this pandemic. You know, there's a lot of kids doing things at home, especially with at-home learning, and there's a lot more reading being done at home. And so I think it's great that they're continuing this, and it's another little way that people can kind of contribute when they're out there doing their own shopping. So let's see. It looks like we have Mike on the phone from Waterbury who has a question about a book recommendation, I think. Good morning, Mike.
Hello. It's not so much a recommendation. It's kind of a statement. Your guest was asking for a stumper. I don't know if this is a stumper, but I'm curious if he has followed this thread. Anyway, I'll try to make it quick. Apocalypse Now, when I first watched it, I was talking to a friend of mine, and I said, oh, this is based on Joseph Conrad's The Heart of Darkness. And he said, yes, but if you look in the movie so closely, there's a book on Colonel Gatch's bedside that's The Golden Bough. So I bought The Golden Bough. And there were some of the stuff in there. I would say some of the chapter headings were not to touch the earth, not to see the sun. And I was like, those are lyrics from The Doors, who also happened to be the people who did the theme song, The End, for Apocalypse Now. I was wondering if you had any opinion on which of those two books it was based on, or both, or neither.
Well, I think it was based on The Heart of Darkness by Joseph Conrad. The character named Kurtz and all of that it was influenced by that. I love the connection you made with The Doors.
Stephen, I'm hoping you might have brought some of your favorite matches that you've made so far with people asking for some suggestions for people that might be quirky or tough to match up and buy for on their lists.
It's funny. I think about I've had some really interesting challenges this year and the different interests that people have. And I find there are certain books that I go back to a lot. I find there are a lot of teenagers that I think would still be interested in what Kurt Vonnegut had to say.
Hmm.
A lot of young men think that they don't like to read, but they're really into sports. And if you can connect them with a great sports book like The Boys in the Boat, then they become readers because it's a great athlete story. And the thing I haven't seen a lot of this year, I haven't had one request for a poetry recommendation, and not as much biography. And I don't love the poetry I've read this year, so it wouldn't be probably a contemporary one. But there are certainly Vermont poets that are writing great stuff, and biography is a really, really fun way to learn history, sort of through the personality of individuals. And I haven't had this year. People want fiction, it seems to me. They really want a novel they can lose themselves in. And a lot of people say that, like they want a good escape. They want something where the world will just go away and they're totally caught up in the world of the novel.
I can totally relate to that.
The novel can do. Me too.
Right? I mean, reality is just, I don't know, getting into nonfiction right now. Our whole world right now is nonfiction, and it's kind of scary, stressful nonfiction, right? So I guess
the publishing industry has been really focused on one topic for the last 18 months anyway, or 2 years, and it's nonfiction. And, you know, I think that topic hopefully is going to really shift a lot on January 20th. And so then I think the market's going to open up for other kinds of titles.
Right.
It's been the Trump presidency. That's really what the nonfiction business has been about. And the memoir by former President Obama. Those have been the dominating nonfiction books.
Right. Well, that's going to be this one that everybody's anticipating at this point to see it. I think he said that it's volume one.
Right. Right.
So he'll be working on another one, and we'll see how his book tour looks. It's probably going to be another virtual book tour from him as well.
I think it is, but it's the things like the NEA Awards and the National Book Awards, you know, a little different than we see in New England.
They'll have big audiences. You know, one thing I wanted to bring into this conversation, we're talking a lot about independent bookstores and for people to go out and purchase books for the holidays. But another thing, too, that I see with your list is that it's a perfectly good way to also patronize your local library. One of the things that I see happening all around Vermont right now is that libraries, even though they might be, you know, closed to people coming in and browsing, they're still working, and they are online. Their titles are online. They're doing online programs, and a lot of them are doing curbside pickup, and they're taking requests just like what you're doing. You can call up your library staff, and they're making recommendations and stuff. And so that's another way that not everybody can go out and buy an armload of books. And there's lots of books sitting on shelves in libraries, including new releases that they are ready and willing to wrap up and pack up for you to drive up and pick up curbside.
You know, one of the great cultural changes of the last, 10 or 15 years, I'd say, is that the library has gone from this place where somebody sort of schoolmarmish tells everyone to shush into absolute community centers. And, and with so many things going on from toddlers to elderly folks, toddlers learning to read and elderly folks learning to use the internet and everything in between, the library in my town, I think when the school lets out, there's a school bus that just goes directly to the library because there's so many after-school programs from girls who code to chess clubs. And, you know, we have 60 kids in a small town in a chess club. Something's happening there.
Exactly.
And I think it's really fantastic. Yeah, it's really fantastic what a public library has become and what communities have invested in them. Many, many libraries in Vermont have been expanded over the last few years.
They have. We have one in Waterbury.
Yeah.
Shelburne has a brand new library. In fact, they did a really cool thing I saw on their social media this week where they got their bookshelves with new releases and new books, new titles that they've just gotten in, and they pushed them up to their windows so that people could look from outside at what's on the bookshelves that just arrived at the library, and they could browse through the window, and then they could call in and say what books they wanted them to pack up that they could pick up curbside. So people are missing their libraries, I think, right now.
Fantastic. You know, the other thing I do this time of year is I write a winter tale, just a short story that I put on my website for free, just to thank readers for making my life possible as a novelist. And my story this year is set in a town library that's undergoing an expansion.
Excellent.
Where it takes place.
Well, and that story is
happening in Vermont.
That story is on your website, which is stephenpkiernan.com, correct? And
it
disappears, though. This is something that's got a short life. It disappears on New Year's Eve or New Year's Day, something like that?
New Year's Day, it's gone forever, right. From Thanksgiving to New Year's, this is, I think, the 14th year. And, where I just put up a short story. This is, I think, an 8-minute read, maybe quicker. And but it's just a thank you thing. And, yes, it's up there just for 6 weeks and then goodbye forever. And people will write me in mid-January and say, oh, I missed it. Can I see it? And I'll say, it's so nice of you to write. And no, you cannot.
See, I like to bookmark it and then save it to, like, read with my Sunday coffee, first cup of coffee on a Sunday morning kind of thing. It's like a little treat. Anyhow, Stephen, we are just about out of time. I wonder if you might have a book recommendation for me that you can email me later. But at this point, Stephen...
I think you would love This Is Happiness by Neil Williams.
Thank you. Thank you, and happy holidays to you. We're going to take a break now. That's it for Vermont Viewpoint, our show for today, and it's directed by Lee Cattell. Our email address here is vtviewpoint@vermontradiovermont.com, where you can send comments and suggestions for guests and topics. You can also listen to past Vermont Viewpoint programs as podcasts on wdevradio.com. CBS News is up next, followed by Governor Phil Scott's Friday COVID response news conference, live from Montpelier with his cabinet members and the Vermont Press Corps. I'm Lisa Scolodi from WaterburyRoundabout.org. Rick Sangari is back on Monday for more Vermont Viewpoint here on WDEV. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.